Welcome to episode 17 of the Infectious Historians Podcast. I'm Merle Eisenberg.
And I'm Lee Mordecai.
Today is July 5th, and in our episode, we're going to discuss how states and societies are resilient to periods of crises and rebound from them.
One of the big questions in recent research looks at how human societies react to systemic stresses, which can be environmental. So COVID-19 comes to mind now. Today, we're going to talk to a leading expert on this subject and get his take on the resilience of historical societies to stresses in the pre-modern world. Our guest today is Professor John Halden. John is the Shelby Cullum Davis 1930 Professor of European History Emeritus at Princeton University. And incidentally, John was also my main advisor as a graduate student at Princeton, and really the key reason why I decided to come to Princeton for graduate studies.
I would say, and I think Lee would agree, that John is one of the greatest Byzantine historians, and has written, he tells us, 18 monographs, 8 edited volumes, and 143 articles, with another 12 in press. We had him count his CV right beforehand. We'll mention 3 of John's key books today. The first is The State and the Tributary Mode of Production, written in 1993, which is a wonderful theoretical discussion of neo-Marxist theory and how it can be used to frame how we write history today. I often recommend it to people in all types of fields. The second is Byzantium in the 7th Century, originally published in 1990, which sketches out how the Byzantine state transformed following the loss of about 3/4 of its territory during the early Islamic conquest. I also just have to say that I picked this book up as a sophomore in college, and it was the first serious history book I think I read, and I think I've told John this, but it's probably the reason why I became a late antique historian. The third book is The Empire That Would Not Die, The Paradox of Eastern Roman Survival, which came out in 2016, and returns to the 7th century to look at how the empire survived during the Islamic conquest rather than what happened afterward. And this is going to be the focus of our talk today.
The last book also ties into some of John's current research interests. Over the past several years, really since 2013 or so, John has been the director of the CCHRI, or Climate Change and History Research Initiative at Princeton. Through this role, John has made groundbreaking contributions to the study of environmental history, focusing on the different interactions between the environment and human societies. I'll also add here that John is the reason I found myself in environmental history. I remember I came into his office once and asked him about a side project to do. He suggested environmental history, and this was right at the beginning of the CCHRI, and he could use a research assistant. So I agreed. I wasn't super into the topic at first, but as I read more and engaged with the CCHRI's activities, I realized this was a fascinating and pertinent topic. And in the 7 or so years since, I've been moving into the field up to a point that most of my research and about half my classes now focus on different aspects of environmental history. So I guess saying yes in a random meeting 7 years ago was really significant for me.
So hi, John.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So as usual in our episodes, we begin by describing the local effects of COVID-19 where we are. So Lee, how are things in Jerusalem?
So here, the second wave is becoming more serious. The number of new infections over Friday and Saturday was over 1,000 per day. And considering that we had about 10 infections a day in May, it's a pretty substantial increase, right? So about 100 times more. Now, the public sphere continues to function, and that shows how much of COVID's social effects are really based on fear and expectations. So in March and April, we had considerably less infections, and about a third of the number of infections on average, but people took it way more seriously back then, as opposed to today in which, I mean, most of society seems to function as usual. I mean, people are outside, cafes are full, people are getting together, having celebrations and so on. So it's interesting to see how this will continue. But I think there are signs in which people are starting to stress. They're stressing both about COVID, but also about the potential of another lockdown. And people really do not want that here. So how are you, Merle? Where are you these days? Are you back in Annapolis yet?
Yeah, so I drove back down to Annapolis yesterday. It's a pretty smooth, easy drive. Again, no one on the roads, although that might have to do with the fact that we've drove on the 4th of July. So happy Independence Day to you, Lee, and to you, John. We won.
We'll come back to that.
Most people seem masked up here in Annapolis. The cases in Anne Arundel County have been fairly flat and decreasing for a number of weeks. We went to Baker's & Co. this morning to get a bunch of bread and pastries. Leah, did you ever go there?
No, I don't think so.
Probably the best small bakery in the walkable Annapolis area. So they have a system where you order the night before and you just give them your name. You don't go inside the store and you just pick up your bag of baked goods. And everyone waits outside 6 feet apart, masked up. It was pretty heartening to see in that regard. And then from there, we went to the local farmer's market, which is outside, and bought a bunch of vegetables and came home.
What about the fire station?
We went to the fire station on the way home, of course. Like. So, John, where are you and what's it like there?
So I am in Birmingham in the UK, which is where my family home is. As you guys know, I have one of the worst carbon footprints in academia since I've been commuting between the US and the UK for nearly 20 years. So actually COVID-19 and the lockdown has been beneficial in that respect, that I've no longer been able to travel so much. The situation here is relatively calm, I would say. We had a fairly well-observed and fairly well-policed lockdown from the middle of March until last week, or maybe 10 days ago. And then a number of relaxation measures were introduced until at this weekend, things were opened up a little bit more. Pubs and restaurants, for example, providing they had all the right social distancing and disinfectant measures in place, could open for business. Some businesses can't open, depending on the circumstances in which they would normally operate, of course. On the whole, people have been fairly observant, although there are occasional moments of stupidity or madness or recklessness. As, for example, we had a very hot weekend last week, and the beaches down on the south coast were absolutely rammed with people, like sardines in a tin. It was absurd. So probably in about 2.5 weeks from now, quite a lot of those people may well find themselves feeling not quite so well. But it's hard to tell how this virus is behaving. It's the more we know about it, the more complex its impacts on different populations and sectors of the population appear to be. My own opinion is that the lockdown has done a lot of good in this country, even though I think our government, for ideological reasons primarily, should have locked down a lot earlier than they did, and therefore the mortality rate in Britain was much higher than it need have been. So I think if we include all the directly COVID-related deaths, it's slightly over 44,000 now, which is high. Although other countries, including the US, are rapidly catching up, of course. But now that things have relaxed, I think people are being a little bit anxious about whether we'll have a second peak. The science says that we almost certainly will have, if not a second peak, a second wave, which may come in sort of mini waves, depending on which part of the country we're in. And we may then have more local lockdowns, such as the one that's currently operating in a town just to the north of here, about 30 miles north of Birmingham, called Leicester.
From what I understand, pubs open this weekend. Have you been to your local pub yet?
I have not, but I've booked myself and two colleagues in, both of whom are CCHRI-affiliated colleagues. We're booked in. We have a table, no hands-on service table in a local pub about 2 miles from here. All the pubs you have to book in advance to. You can only get in under certain ID-specified conditions.
So you book for how long? I mean, how many hours can you stay in the pub?
As long as you want, providing you book. So we booked for 9 and we'll stay till they shut at 11.
What is a no hands table?
So first of all, there's, as you know, in English pubs, you get your drinks at the bar and then you go and find somewhere to stand, sit or lie, depending on your state. Now there's no standing at the bar. It's all table service, which for British people is a civilizational revolution. So that could be quite good. It also means, however, that you're not supposed to make contact with anybody on the service staff at all. So everything's done by card swipe or using an app on your phone or whatever. Cash will not change hands, as far as I'm aware. It's all done electronically and remotely. And the drinks will be brought to your table by somebody who will be presumably fully PPE'd and will scuttle away as quick as they can before you breathe on. So we'll see how it works out.
You guys need some of the bars that I saw open in DC. and presumably elsewhere, where they have the taps directly in the table, and then you can just pour your own beers.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds too dangerous. I think we'd find that the rate of alcoholism went through the roof.
That's what I think would happen. But I think they've been well controlled, but probably in a situation in which people haven't been to a pub in months, it might go very poorly.
Yeah. I think probably what's going to happen, because as Lee said about Israel, everyone's terrified of another lockdown, not just for economic reasons, but for social, psychological, and personal, emotional reasons. So my suspicion, and all the schools are definitely going back in September at the normal start time. I think they'll find it very hard to go back on that, because so many people need kids to be in school so they can actually get to work. So I suspect what will happen is that government and the scientists, even though regretfully, will have to accept that this is an endemic situation, and that we'll have local waves and peaks, and that we'll just have to cope. Not only with the mortality rate and the loss of life, but with the impact on healthcare provision, hospitals, and so forth.
What about international travel with the EU?
We still have a 14-day quarantine period for British people coming back to the UK from wherever they've been. They need to go straight home and stay there. The problem is, of course, this is hard to police.
Unless you have a surveillance state.
We've got that in towns, but not in the suburbs or in the countryside. So I guess you could, but then, you know, who's going to spend time looking at those cameras and checking on people? The personnel requirements for this sort of surveillance are massive. You can imagine the old German Democratic Republic managing this because of its spy system, possibly the Soviet Union in some parts in the old days, and maybe China today. But even that's probably exaggerated.
I mean, we have it automatic. I mean, in Israel, we currently have an automatic surveillance system. So everyone's phones are tracked. And if you somehow stand next to a person who will later be discovered as someone who had COVID-19, you'd get a text message telling you to go self-quarantine yourself. And they would know if you leave self-quarantine if you take your phone with you.
That's the advantage that I have. I don't have a phone, you see. So I can do. There's a lot of people in this country don't have a smartphone or an iPhone. It's not a high number, but I mean, it's probably more than 15% of the phone carrying population don't have a phone. So our system can't depend. I mean, they did try and introduce an app back in April, but the experiment failed because a lot of people either don't look at their phones, don't turn their phones on, or don't have a phone. It's a phone-using society, but not as intensely phone-using as some other parts of the quote-unquote Western world. And my main concern is selfish now. I just want to make sure I get up to my holiday place in Northern England away from everybody.
Let's start off the discussion. We're hearing a lot about how respective countries or communities can rebound from COVID-19. This can be defined perhaps as resilience. Can you give us a very brief, short definition of what that means, since different fields and different people define it in various ways?
Sure. So as you said, different fields define it in different ways. The way I use it is based primarily on the way in which ecologists deploy it, which is to say that resilience defines the qualities of a system, any set of relationships that allow it to bounce back from or recover a degree of equilibrium without substantial systemic change. In other words, the system is still clearly identifiable after the moment of resilience as the same system that was impacted to begin with by whatever crisis caused the problem. There are different definitions. I won't run through them all now. Some require, for example, in engineering, resilience involves different sorts of response to stresses and not necessarily no systemic change at all. But for the human sciences, I think using resilience in combination with another term, transformation, gives us a slightly more sophisticated or nuanced vocabulary for describing socioeconomic and cultural change over both the long and short term.
So why would this be a useful way, to your mind, to analyze states and societies in pre-modern times?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the first reason is because if you think in those terms, you have to start looking at how a society works. What are its key components? What gives it systemic identity? Why do we call it this sort of society or that sort of society, for example? And how do the different parts of that system operate together to produce the whole? You can take a society apart, like a motor car engine. You can see how the thing works by putting it all back together again, of course. If you have a bit left over at the end, you've done something wrong. And you can analyze societies in the same way. You need to put things back together again. But in the process of taking it apart and putting it back together again, you learn a lot about how these parts interact, how they interface with one another. And if you ask, why is this society resilient when stressed by whatever it is that we're talking about, a historical event, a crisis of some sort, you need to ask yourself, and you need to ask your different types of data and source, what are the components that responded in a particularly resilient or non-resilient way, and why did they respond in that particular way?
So you mentioned systems. Can you say a bit more about what exactly does that mean when we talk about a society? Would a system be a society? Would a system be a society in its surroundings, for example, its environment? And what exactly would be considered a system?
Okay, so it's a good question because, of course, the word system implies a sort of rigidity or mechanistic model. And of course, one of the things we mustn't forget to build into our study of society or social systems is people and people's ability to make choices and to have intentions, and for those intentions to be misconstrued and for their actions to have impacts that they didn't expect them to have, which is nearly always the case, in fact. The system has to be used carefully. The way I like to think of them is in, again, using some ecology, is in terms of complex adaptive systems. That's to say, sets of relationships which constantly respond and interface with their environment. Now, the second part of your question is, where does the environment part fit in? And the environment is, of course, the physical environment, the geographical space they inhabit. It's also a temporal environment. In other words, there are paces of development or paces of activity through time, which one can talk about and specify. And then there is also, let's call it the climatic environment is a bit too simplistic, but the context in which both the landscape and geography and the spaces they inhabit physically and the cultural and social institutions that they generate in their day-to-day social practice are also influenced by.
So if I understand correctly, when you say system, you mean a society and also its environment and let's say its economy and ideology and politics. So all of these would be part of the same system, so to speak.
Correct. Yes.
So what are some perhaps challenges with this broad approach? I mean, I can think of one off the top of my head, which is you could say using your idea, you could deconstruct the system and the society and maybe isolate one variable too much and say that the environment causes all of these other changes to happen. But what are some other issues that might arise while you're doing this work?
Yes, again, it's a very good question, Merle. There are lots of isms in the social sciences, or indeed in any science, I suppose. But there are various forms of determinism, which are the sorts of things you just mentioned, where one takes a particular element and makes that the prime mover and influence of everything else. You could also call that reductionism, if you like. You could have environmental reductionism. You can have, famously, in traditional Marxism, you've got economic reductionism, where economic relationships determine everything else. And when we look at societies in a more complex way, we see that that's part of the case, but by no means all of the case. And there are, if you like, ideological reductionisms as well, whereby we reduce human societies to the sets of ideas that those societies actually themselves have generated. In actuality, what we need to do is to have a balanced approach where each of the different elements that we want to isolate is kept in appropriate relationship with all the other elements so that we generate what we would call a holistic approach. And that's where I come back to the model of the car engine. You've got to take it apart to see how it works, but you've got to put it back together again to see what comes out of it. you know, the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts. And the same is absolutely true of thinking about societies as well.
Yes, yeah, so that's very helpful. And maybe a way to continue would be to zoom in into a case study or a specific car engine, to use that analogy as an example. So you work on the Eastern Roman Empire or the Byzantine Empire. Could you give us a very brief overview of what exactly that is while focusing on the 7th century, which we've already heard is a difficult century for the empire?
Without giving you one of the lectures you've already heard over the last several years, that's a tall order, but I'll try and do that as briefly as I can. So the Eastern Roman Empire or Byzantine Empire is basically the eastern half of the Roman Empire that everyone's familiar with. And that means part of Italy and the East Mediterranean basin and the Middle East, or some of the Middle East and the Near East part, like modern Turkey. And then when we go into the 6th and 7th centuries, although these periodizations are a little bit arbitrary and very variable, when we go into the 7th century, we have a society that is much more focused on Greek language as the medium of official discourse and literature, for example, much more focused on what we would now call Orthodox Christianity as the main organized form of religious belief of most of society, and a particular form of administrative and organizational structure. And this is the Byzantine Empire that lasts through until it finally disappears in 1453, when the very last bits of it fall to the Ottoman Turks. Well, actually, the very last bit of it falls in 1461, and it's the little enclave of the so-called Empire of Trebizond on the Black Sea. But the empire was a major territorial and maritime power for a lot of its history, from the 6th right up into the 12th century, with ups and downs. And one of the downs, one of the big downs, if you like, is the 7th and early 8th centuries. And the reason for that is that the empire suddenly found itself almost overwhelmed by a whole series of major impacts, from hostile invasion and migratory movements on the one hand, as well as from epidemic, population and demographic decline, a range of other environmental factors which we don't fully understand, and internal political and economic changes, which brought it to near extinction. And yet it survived. And one of the interesting questions is, how does that sort of state, which loses a huge amount, I mean, if you think about the losses to the Islamic conquest between the beginning of the 630s, 633, up to the early 640s, the East Roman Empire loses probably two-thirds of its territory and three-quarters of its income. And as you've often heard me say before, hardly any states that we can envisage could have survived that sort of shock. And yet it does. So it does become an interesting question. What made it so resilient?
So you've basically just asked the next natural question to yourself, but I'll re-ask it, which is, how does it survive? And obviously this is the focus of a lot of your work, but maybe we could just poke at, you give us a couple of the big key themes, and then we can follow up about them in detail.
Sure. Using what I call my holistic approach, what I try to do is to look at all the different elements that may have contributed to that survival. So what does that include? It includes the degree of, let's call it, structural robustness. In other words, how strong was its administrative apparatus? How strong was its political system? The relationship between elites and the rest of the population, or perhaps more importantly, and we can talk about this in a minute, the relationship between the center and the elites in the provinces. That's one aspect. Another aspect might be, how important were ideological factors? In other words, how important was identity a significant factor? If we think about some examples in more recent history, we find that the ways in which people identify together against an external threat often plays a very important role in their ability to withstand even the most horrendous attacks. One can think of the populations of some of the cities in Europe that suffered very high rates of bombardment and destruction both in England and more particularly in Germany in 1945, for example. One can think of the destruction wrought by Nazi forces on people and society in the Ukraine and the western part of the Soviet Union in 1942 to 44, 45, and so forth. And there are lots of other cases I'm sure you can think of. So how did people identify, and did this mode of identification create a sort of degree of societal solidarity that helped them overcome some of the problems? A third set would be the environmental factors. Was there anything about climate, weather conditions, even on an annual or decadal basis, that either contributed to or hindered East Roman stroke Byzantine survival in that period? And then, of course, there are things that we could call extraneous factors. What was happening in the world around the East Roman Empire that may have contributed towards their ability to survive? And there are some important points there that have to be made as well. And then additionally, there are a lot of, let's call them subordinate points within each of those bigger categories. So one of them, which is really important, is indeed the very strategic and physical situation of the capital city of the empire, Constantinople, which weathered two serious attacks and sieges, but had very effective defenses in place with which to achieve that. You know, you can take all these factors and give them different weightings, but in the end, you need to examine each of them and see how they appear when you look at all the data we have. And for some of them, we don't have very much data, it has to be said. For others, we have a lot more. And then put them all together and see how they interrelate. And that's the biggest problem, in a sense, is how do you interrelate the question of identities with, say, environmental matters or the fiscal system, how the state raised taxes and so forth. So in a way, the trick is not taking each of these and working out what the data is telling you about each of them. The trick is to put them all together in a meaningful set of causal connections so that you explain what the outcome was.
So the problem with data that you mentioned, the fact that data, especially in these types of questions, can be incommensurable. So, I mean, fitting together data about, or evidence, let's say, about identity to evidence about geography isn't that intuitive in a sense, which that's a problem I've been encountering both in my own work, but also it's very clearly one of the big questions we're trying to solve in this type of interdisciplinary study. But to move on, to connect the Eastern Roman state or empire to the discussion about resilience that we had earlier on, so what would be the key factors that determined whether the Eastern Roman Empire was resilient to these changes or not? Was it identity? Was it the environment? What made them work?
So obviously I'm going to jump two or three analytical sort of stages to answer the question. If I just go back to your very first point, incommensurability is obviously a major issue. We can't ever come to an answer which is 100% in terms of interlocking all the different elements. They won't match up. They can't, because A, they're of different quality and type. B, they're different quantity, and C, they often have different temporalities. So matching climate data to political history data is very difficult, and people try to do it and they end up reproducing one of these isms, a reductionism or a determinism. What we can do, though, is to build hypotheses which are more or less probable. And as long as your hypothesis does generally take into account every single bit of evidence, even the bits that tend not to make any sense or that you can't figure out properly, if your hypothesis can cope with all of that, you've got a probable hypothesis, and that's the working model that you can push forward on. As soon as somebody comes along with an alternative which actually matches the data better, then you need to rethink your hypothesis. So that's the only way we can work, of course. And that's the way all historians either have, do, or should work. And one of the things that has always annoyed me is the idea that you can produce a hypothesis which is fixed and finished, and that's it. We don't need to revisit it.
I just want to point out to listeners that the idea that you should actually use everything that you can find, all types of evidence that could be inserted into your model, is not obvious at all, and is actually one of the important shifts, in at least in my thinking, over the past few years.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Anyway, let's jump ahead to the meat of your question about the 7th century East Roman, medieval East Roman Empire. As I think you both will know, I isolated five sets of factors, and I've mentioned most of them in slightly different language a few minutes ago. I'll tell you a story in a sense. I set out with this very difficult question, thinking that surely the real key must be a question of identity. The main reason why the East Roman Empire survived was because the people who occupied provinces that made up the core of the East Roman Empire had an unshakable common identity that helped them resist the invasion from the Islamic Arabs in the course of the 7th century. The difficulty with that is that once you start looking at the evidence, you see that actually quite often when an Islamic army invades, everyone just gives up. They didn't fight. They either ran away or they surrendered, including local elites. And we don't have a lot of evidence for this, and some of it comes from Islamic sources themselves, which are slightly suspect, not because we don't believe them or they're more plausible than the contemporary Byzantine or other sources from that region, Syria or Armenia or whatever, but because they're nearly all written down 200 years later. And so we have a problem of transmission and reliability. But to get back to the main point, it was clear once I'd started looking at the evidence more carefully that whether or not you identified as an Orthodox Christian Roman didn't really affect whether or not you resisted the invaders. After all, most of the people who succumbed very quickly to the invaders in Palestine, Syria, and Western Iraq, or indeed Egypt, were all self-identifying Christian Romans. They didn't resist very much at all. One or two isolated cases, but mostly they didn't resist. So I couldn't really work with the idea of identity, at least not at that level. When I began to look more closely at the political relationships, however, between Constantinople and the different regional elites of the empire, I found something quite interesting. The nearer you were to Constantinople, and it's actually really obvious, just that nobody had sort of spotted it or made it obvious before, and particularly if you're in the Aegean region or the South Balkan region or Anatolia, modern Turkey, the easier it is for the state to reach out and to punish you or to deal with you if you are disloyal. Whereas if you're further away, for example, in North Africa or Italy or even Assyria, you can't reach people in the same way or as quickly. That's one factor. A second factor is, what did people in the regions which were conquered think about the empire's ability to protect them? So here we go back to a sort of ideational motif, if you like. It was very clear to people in Syria in the 630s that the empire was either struggling or failing completely to come to their aid. And so it was far more sensible for them to give in, to avoid being killed or sacked and so forth, than it was to resist. And famously, the only place that did resist for a long time was Caesarea Maritima in Israel now on the coast, which resisted and eventually, and because it could be supplied by sea, resisted for 6 years, but eventually fell, and all the garrison were reportedly slaughtered and the place was razed to the ground. So we have two factors. One is, how close do you feel the empire is to helping you? And two is, how close is the empire to punishing you if you don't resist? And you can see that difference in the response of different elites regionally. So, for example, in Anatolia, as soon as Arab forces occupy fortresses beyond the Taurus, i.e. on the Anatolian plateau, local Byzantine elites got together with their local forces and drove them out. And they were never able to establish a foothold there. And local elites that didn't play ball on the East Roman side, the emperor marched out and punished them, removed them from their office or whatever. So there's a series of sticks and carrots that were employed. It also depended on the international situation. North African elites stayed loyal a little bit longer because they were less threatened and they had maritime contacts to the center. Italian elites stayed loyal for longer because direct connections by sea with Constantinople were much more more readily maintained. And if those elites could be woven into the fabric of the state and rewarded appropriately for their loyalty, then that loyalty could be guaranteed for the future. And that's how the government basically did it. To put it really crudely, it bought the elite's loyalty.
So this factor you mentioned seems like it might work for many pre-modern societies in general. Was there something particularly unique to Byzantium that they were able to do this as opposed to other states in the pre-modern world? Or is this something you could see perhaps more broadly applicable across different states and societies?
So this goes to the point that we were talking about earlier about whether we have a single cause or many causes. So we have to put all those things I just talked about into the bigger context, along with all the other things that were going on. One of those other things is the fact that the East Roman state did have an extraordinarily, for the period, extraordinarily efficient internal logistics. It had a Roman road system that worked very, very well. But it also, crucially, had a very efficient bureaucracy. Now, bureaucracy in the modern sense, there wasn't. And we need to be careful what we mean by bureaucracy, because it's compromised in all sorts of ways that would make it look remarkably unbureaucratic and inefficient to somebody comparing it with, say, a modern European or North American civil service structure. But for the period and for the context, it was very efficient. It maximized the extraction of resources from the provinces. It redeployed those resources very effectively through the elite to maintain military potential to resist invasion, and more importantly, to resist occupation of land. As I said, every time the Arabs took a fortress and occupied it, they were driven out. They didn't hold a single fortress beyond a certain line. And that's where we can bring in environmental factors, because that line represents a significant change in annual climate and seasonality on the one hand, but also in terms of access to resources through communications on the other. So that also plays a role. So you can see how if you take each of these factors by themselves, they're important. When you string them together and try and relate them causally, you can begin to make a more coherent picture of the whole.
Yeah, so I think that that's a good place to move a bit deeper into the environment or environmental questions. So could you say a bit more about how the environment affects the survival or resilience of the East Roman state?
Sure. So I think the first thing is to say that we often think of people being conscious of changes in their environment because we are. We're sensitized to environmental changes and shifts. And even long before serious environmental threats to the global system were detected, i.e. before the 1960s and 70s, we still understood a little bit more about weather patterns and impacts of volcanism and earthquakes and so forth than medieval people did or could. So the crucial point to bear in mind here is that things were going on environmentally of which people were largely unaware because they took a long time to actually happen. So a shift in climate that makes an area slightly wetter than it had been before doesn't usually happen in under 50 to 100 years. It might happen in a way that you notice because every 3 or 4 years there's unusually heavy winters and rainfall and so forth, but then you revert back to where you were before, and then you think, well, things are fine. It's only when there's an accumulation of transformations over a longer period that then becomes something different that if you're aware of it at all, you realize there's been a change. Now, we are aware of things like that because we have records and we have longer social memory because of radio, TV and books and all sorts of other things, but medieval people didn't have. And they certainly didn't talk about the weather in the same way. So there's no record in that sense. One or two exceptions to do with Egypt and the Nile, for example, we can think of, but mostly no. However, the changes that were happening don't mean that people weren't affected by them, whether they knew they were happening or not. Farmers, for example, do respond to shifts in their environmental conditions. They do respond to arid periods or wet periods in terms of the impact it has on their crops or their ability to market those crops. And what we find in the what's called the late antique period, that's to say the period from the 3rd and 4th centuries up until the 7th and 8th centuries, are a series of fluctuations in aridity and humidity across the whole Mediterranean and Western European world, which are themselves reflections of much bigger changes globally to do with monsoons and various other things which you don't need to go into. But one of the outcomes of this was that in Anatolia and the southern Balkans, in the course of the 6th and 7th centuries, it actually got wetter. Not very much wetter. It was a few centimeters of rain more in the wet seasons and slightly wetter summers. But this obviously had an impact on what you can grow and where you can grow it. And one of the things that we think, and we can't yet demonstrate it beyond a shadow of doubt because we don't have enough data, but one of the things that we think may have been happening is that it became more possible to produce more grain proportional to the population in parts of Anatolia than had been produced before. And this impacted on the state's ability to supply and support its military forces, because armies need two things in particular. They need bread, basically. We're talking about the Western Eurasian world. They need bread and they need livestock. Livestock both for food, but also for all the other things that you get from an animal. And what we notice in the paleoenvironmental data is a patchy but very significant change from a traditional Eastern Mediterranean farming crops, focusing on olives and fruit, towards grain and livestock, more pastoral or semi-pastoral activities. It's not universal and it's patchy, but it's significant and it coincides with exactly this crisis period.
So we're actually saying that there is an interaction. So on one hand, the environment is changing. I mean, there is slow climate change, an increase in precipitation. So areas become wetter and presumably that helps crops. And on the other hand, we see a social response to this. So the society is actually reacting to climate change and adapting, essentially.
Yes, and that's where we have a little problem or a big problem, depending on how important you think this is, because we don't know to what extent farmers or landowners responded to this minor shift in climate conditions to change what they were growing, and to what extent this change just happened to coincide with the climatic changes, but it was forced by the government. And I tend to favor the latter. And the reason I do that is because we know from earlier late Roman economic policy in Italy that governments could indeed, through tax policies, force landlords or landowners to produce more of something that the government wanted. So in southern Italy, both archaeologically and a few texts in the 5th century, we know that the government at Rome encouraged, in inverted commas, encouraged, forced, if you want, in some ways, through tax policy, landowners to produce more grain for the armies in Italy. Well, the archaeological evidence is fairly clear, and it's generally agreed that this is what was involved. But the point is, if a Roman government in the 5th century had that as a resource, there's no reason why a Roman government in the Eastern Empire in the 7th century couldn't have thought similarly. We need more soldiers' support. We need more things to maintain our troops and civil service and so forth. Let's make farmers pay more of their crop in grain than hitherto. And that impacted then on the farming pattern. I'm not excluding market forces because they also clearly played a role. One of the things that I haven't mentioned is that there's a fundamental shift in longer distance and medium distance commerce and trade at this period, which certainly impacted on markets and what people would produce for what market.
So part of what you're saying is that as the government lost territory, revenue, land, etc., it was able to coerce, force farmers to shift what they were growing, which enabled the state in some ways to survive long term.
Yes. Yeah. That's definitely one part of the picture. And it's a very important part because, as we saw earlier, the state had lost a huge amount of resource and land. The other thing is, of course, Anatolia is the poorest part of the Eastern Roman Empire in terms of what the land will produce. You know, the richest provinces are Egypt and Syria. Those were gone. And North Africa as well after the 690s. So all it was left with was these relatively poor parts of Anatolia and a little bit of what's now Greece and Turkey and Europe, but not much of it. And those parts were always challenged and threatened by constant hostile harassment of one sort or another.
To complicate things even further, during all of this, there's also an ongoing plague pandemics. So several outbreaks of what is often described as the Justinianic plague. And this has come into some sort of controversy over the past, let's say, year or so. But what effects would you see the Justinianic plague having, if any, over the 7th century in particular, let's say?
Yeah, that's a good question, but it's a hard one to answer. The first thing is that the environmental evidence from the sort of data that we use to estimate what was being grown on the land and how much was being grown on the land doesn't really give us any indication of dramatic demographic decline or collapse until at least a generation after the first wave of this Justinianic plague struck in the 540s. So it's not really until the 570s or later that we can see any indication of dramatic population decline through the evidence, the proxies that we would use to estimate what's being grown on the land. And of course, it may not be just to do with the plague. There may be other factors such as warfare involved as well. Of course, that doesn't really affect the 7th century. It does affect the question of the extent to which the empire was suffering economic difficulties in the reigns of the emperors after Justinian, particularly Justin II, but more importantly, Tiberius, and then the Emperor Maurice. And it may be that we need to build that more into our understanding of what was going on there. When we get into the 7th century, we have occasional references to highly localized outbreaks of this plague. And the evidence, as you know, suggests that it is indeed a bubonic plague. It is Yersinia pestis. But as we also understand now, much better than we used to, plague can be accompanied by a range of other diseases and illnesses. And so its effects can be amplified in all sorts of different contexts with different outcomes. To be honest, I don't really see any major role for the plague in the breakdown of imperial resistance to, say, the Arab Islamic invasions in the 630s in the Middle East. And we know that the plague remains endemic right up until the 740s. And yet at that point in the 730s, 740s, the empire has stabilized the situation and is actually pushing back against further Arab Islamic encroachment. And we must also bear in mind, of course, that the Arab Islamic world was presumably just as badly affected in parts and regionally as the East Roman Empire.
Has anyone made the suggestion that the early Islamic conquest might have been stopped or curtailed because of plague outbreaks, say in the 630s and 640s. The Islamic sources, with the problems of transmission you laid out, suggest that there were plague outbreaks during the early conquest. And I don't know if anyone suggested that that's a reason why maybe they stopped where they did.
I think people have thought about it, but the point is they didn't really stop where they did. I mean, they carry on expanding right into the 750s on the northern frontier with China, for example. 751, they're pushing well into what's now northwest China, and they're still, you know, mounting major expeditionary forces against Constantinople in the early 8th century. And then, of course, you have the what's called the Abbasid Revolution in the late 740s, 750s, when one dynastic regime is replaced by another, which relocates its focus of cultural and political interest to what's now Iraq, based around what becomes the city of Baghdad. That might be a situation in which we could probably find a greater role for plague than the question of the expansion of Islam. In other words, it may have played a much bigger role internally in the conflicts that took place. There are three civil wars within the Islamic world in the first century. It could have played a role there that we haven't really been able to pinpoint. The problem is that sources don't themselves make it any sort of a causal factor. And for the most part, even where plague is endemic, it's never talked about. And I think that's an interesting point. Once something becomes endemic, it loses interest for the people who suffer from it even. It becomes part of daily life. It's just one of the dangers and challenges that one has to face every day when one gets up in the morning.
So I ask this question because often, as you know, the plague is used as an explanation for, say, why Justinian and his various armies failed to reconquer Italy or fight back against the Persians, and also in particular why perhaps long-term the Islamic conquests happen, which is a problematic causal link, but it's often suggested. Mm-hmm. But it's rarely, it seems to me, connected to early Islamic issues at all.
Yeah, I think the loss of Italy to the Lombards in the 560s and 570s, I don't see a role for the plague there and being a problem. I can find perfectly good reasons for the failure of the East Roman Empire to defend its territory and its infrastructure in Italy without needing the plague, even if one were to concede, as one probably should, that clearly if there's something which is impacting on the health of both the resident population and the military on the one hand, and impacting on demographic resources on the other, it must have also played a contributory role in some way. But to make it the prime mover, I think, is always going to be a mistake, unless you've got something really dramatic where you can demonstrate that that's the case, such as the Black Death in 14th century Europe.
So plague is not a necessary factor in these changes?
I think it's a contributory factor, but I think these changes would have happened without plague.
So I think this has been a really helpful discussion, both in terms of defining what resilience is and giving us an example. How might some of these historical approaches that we've been discussing today be useful for us during COVID-19, for example, right? I see a lot of discussion about rebounding from this, you know, will there be a roaring 20s? And we'll leave aside whether or not we want there to be a roaring 20s, but that's a discussion I've seen. So do you have thoughts on this?
It's easy to make pronouncements based on one's historical knowledge, which when you start looking at them more carefully, don't really have much purchase on contemporary realities. The two or three things I would say would be that the first thing we can look at, if we want to use the past to think about how the present and future are going to reconfigure as a result of a pandemic, we can look at some of the impacts of past pandemics and see how governments and populations responded to challenges to their day-to-day lives, either in terms of economics or in terms of religion and belief and so forth. And one of the things that we know that I think will impact on all the countries that have been affected by COVID-19 eventually, in different ways according to their own sociocultural configuration, if you like, and economic system. One of the things that is going to become very clear is that different sectors of a population are affected very, very differently according to economic, sociocultural, and other status. So poverty is probably a much bigger killer than the plague. It's just that because we're used to it and we see it as part of a particular sociocultural system, we tend not to take it as such a dramatic impact. But when you combine poverty and deprivation on the one hand with overcrowded living conditions and pandemic on the other, then you can see some of the deleterious outcomes. And they, to some extent, can certainly be guarded against in the future, providing politicians have the courage to invest in the appropriate rearrangements, if you like. Similarly, just as a sort of side comment on that, the impact on elderly people in care homes and care facilities in all the countries that we know of has been substantially greater than that on virtually any other sector of the population. And so that's something, again, which we also find in the past, not that there were care homes in the past in most societies, but that the elderly and the infirm are the first to go. Very occasionally, that's not the case. So, for example, with the great flu pandemic of the early 1920s, it was actually young people who suffered more than the very elderly. But there are very specific reasons for that, to do with the nature of that flu virus, as we all know. If one looks broadly in terms of broad patterns, there are certain things one can extract from understanding the past, both in terms of structural changes one could make to guard against such tragic consequences in certain population sectors on the one hand, and structural changes one can make to adjust the balance across society between the privileged and the underprivileged.
Yes, so these are important points that resonate with some of the earlier episodes that we've had on this podcast. Before we wrap up, though, one last question, perhaps. Do you think we historians have a role to play in contemporary discourse during the COVID-19 pandemic?
It's interesting to consider that question because history plays a different public role in different societies. So, for example, public intellectuals in France play a much bigger role in discussions about things like this than they do, for example, in England, where they're almost invisible. The US is an interesting mixed case because you have public intellectuals who get involved in that sort of debate, but they're mostly not historians. So the answer is, I suppose, yes, historians really should have a role, for sure. The question is, how do we, as historians, mobilize what we know about the past to make it accessible and useful to policymakers, politicians, as well as the population at large in the present? And that then depends on us getting together, I suppose, and working out what are the key things that we think people ought to know about in terms of responses and potential responses. And I think one of the key things should be disproportionate impacts upon populations sectorally based upon relative wealth, living conditions, educational niveau, and all the rest of it.
So maybe highlight some of these trends that we've seen in the past and how they continue to affect the present.
Yeah.
This is maybe an unfair question. How do we move from awareness to actually making actionable change, right? I mean, this is the problem. I think we're all aware that, at least most people I think are aware, or if they so choose not to be aware, they're purposefully putting blinders on. Most people I think would suggest that people of different demographic, racial, ethnic backgrounds are disproportionately struck by COVID-19. How do we do something about that?
So the obvious thing, I think, is that we, as historians, we need to express our complex understanding of the past in a non-simplistic but very accessible language to people who are specialists in policy development and policy making, as well as politicians. Because if we can inform policymakers, people interested in drafting future policy or future-proof policy, even as some people would call it, if we can explain some of the things that we understand about past societal responses to crisis, past types of resilience and response to change, if we can make that accessible and usable to people involved in the policy and future planning business, then I think that's our best way forward. The alternative is to write popular books about the past, which people will buy, but of course they tend not to have any direct impact. They enlighten people, but they don't change policy and planning. So the way to move forward, I think, is to collaborate with and work alongside people involved in the policy world. And if I can just plug our project briefly at the end, we've begun to try to do that to some extent with some current work that we're doing based in Princeton, where we're working with people involved in North American policymaking for the future with respect to things like dealing with pandemic, but other systemic or environmental crises. So it's a question of communicating as much as anything else. And historians, on the whole, aren't very good at communicating, for one very good reason, and that is that history is actually hard. It's not just telling stories about the past, but it's hard and complex. And to get that complexity and difficulty across with all the caveats that go with any suggestions that we have about solutions is the hardest thing of all. People want clear answers, black and white. We can't always give them clear answers, which are black and white. Just as when you listen to the health specialists and experts briefings about COVID-19, politicians want a yes or no answer. And the health specialists will often say, well, actually, we can't give you a yes or no answer. We can say, if this, then possibly that, but also possibly the other. And I think we're in very much the same boat. But if we can limit the range of possibilities to a certain number and offer a set of choices around which planning could be focused, that's a pretty important contribution we can make.
Yeah, I think this is a good place to end. So we might want to look at COVID-19 as something like an opportunity, right? An opportunity for us historians to make our work more accessible, more better known to a broader public. At least on my side, my feeling based on COVID-19 is that there is, to a certain extent at least, by certain people and surrounding certain questions, but there is a greater interest in the past and in past cases that might provide some example of what is going to happen with COVID-19, how will the world after COVID-19 look like, how would societies react to COVID-19. In a sense, it is an opportunity for us to step forward and become more publicly oriented, maybe not to the same extent as public health people, public health experts, but personally, at least, I could say that definitely more than what I thought a historian should do when, let's say, I started grad school.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, definitely. Part of the issue that we're currently thinking, of course, in all countries affected by COVID, is do we want to go back to where we were at the beginning of all of this? And many people say, no, we don't. Actually, we want things to be different. And then the question becomes, how different? How is that difference introduced? Is it introduced through government policy, politically led change? Is change forced upon the politicians by popular demands or popular movements? And at the moment, we can see all of those things happening in different ways in different countries. Often, those things have nothing to do with COVID-19, but in future, historians will look at, for example, Black Lives Matter protests in the context of COVID-19, and they should find some associations causally. We can see them now because we understand and we can observe them if we're thinking about it. You know, nothing happens in a vacuum.
So COVID-19 is really a catalyst to social change.
It is a change in itself. It's also a catalyst to change. Yeah, just as I was saying, for the East Roman Empire in the 7th century, we need to take a bunch of things together and then interconnect them to understand how they all have the effect that they have. Separately, independent, individually, they won't have that effect. They'll have an effect, but it won't be the one that actually results from the combination of all the factors together.
So with that, I want to wrap up and thank you for your time, John. This has been a wonderful discussion, both in a broad sense of what resilience is and with a particular example that I think really worked very well to understand the question.
And connect to the present.
Thank you both very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
The discussion with John raised a number of, I think, interesting points, not least of which was how complex past societies were and how complex all these factors involving resilience are, right? So how you avoid environmental determinism and other isms, as he coined it.
Yes, I think that's actually a very important point and a point that can be easily overlooked. Right, it's something you always have to keep in mind to keep all these different factors. I mean, the factors that he laid out for us here on the podcast and as he does in his book, we historians should keep all of these in mind and avoid reducing the complexity to one factor. And there's always a strong pull or temptation to do exactly that, to find the one reason because of which, let's say, Rome fell. If we adopt John's approach, which I favor to a great extent, we can't even talk about a single factor. I mean, the complexity approach kind of assumes that there are much more factors in play and they interact with each other.
Yeah, one thing I've always admired about his approach is looking at systems and structures and ways in which it gives you a framework analytically to extrapolate and to look at other situations. So one could take his 7th century idea and look at a series of other states, societies across time and space. And as he pointed out, there's unique aspects to the Byzantine state that allowed it to survive, not least of which he pointed out the administrative and bureaucratic system. But you could certainly test that in other places, I think, pretty easily.
Yeah, that ties into the complex adaptive system idea that he mentioned briefly at some point during the beginning of the interview, which really looks at these systems as being, again, complex. So the system would incorporate anything from the environment to ideology, social structures, institutions, and so on. It's a more difficult approach to pursue, but I think it's much more precise, let's say.
Yeah, it's much more robust, I think is a good way to think.
Yeah, robust is a good word.
The other thing I think he mentioned at the end where I unfairly put him on the spot about historians and what we can do moving forward, I thought he also had a very good answer to as well, which is working with policy people, which I think is something that many of us either don't know how to do or are fearful of doing. But I think he's doing good work that is pushing in that direction.
Yeah, I can speak for myself, and you would probably agree, I guess, is that the COVID-19 kind of forced us along that route, right? It forced us to be more open, try to make our research more accessible, try to speak to audiences that we wouldn't have spoken to otherwise.
I mean, that's why I think we have this podcast, Lee, right? I mean, this was thought up in the first couple of weeks of lockdown of our respective countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a meta level, but yes, it definitely is part of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I think that's one way certainly forward is to think about your work in a larger, accessible, open format.
Which also implies that we need to adapt our message, fit the audiences we're trying to reach. So accessibility is not only talking at public fora, but it's also crafting a message that would make sense to the audience you're speaking to. And that's a learning experience, I guess, for me at least, for quite some time. But I feel slightly optimistic about this, at least because of COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I'll say is there's actually, to use your favorite term, a feedback loop here. I did that one just for you, Lee.
Thank you, Earl. Thanks.
But no, seriously, there's a feedback loop in the sense that I've felt as we've moved to make our own work more accessible, hopefully, through these podcasts, I've learned from other people who are doing the same, right? Say Seth on Native Americans in Hawaii or Fuchsia on social justice and COVID-19, all of these topics that, you know, I knew something about, right? In the sense of I'd heard about them, I'd read a little bit, but I think having people on the podcast has helped me learn about their work, but also hopefully push them into a more public-facing place as well.
Yes, in a sense, it's us all, so both of us, but also the people that we engage with, whether through the podcast or through our writings or our more accessible public-facing writings, to break down silos, right? So break down our silo, break down their silos, and hopefully at least reach some insights that we wouldn't have reached otherwise.
Yeah, that's a good point. So as we conclude this episode, I want to continue our ongoing discussion about academia, Lee, if that's okay. It'll be a little bit more navel-gazily. And I want to know, how are you conducting research now with the limitations on access to your library or other standard university resources?
So at Hebrew, the library is open, has been open for quite some time. I think for most of the time, throughout almost all of the lockdown period, there was a way to access hard copies of books, so to access physical books. One way they had was that you just ordered books and you would come pick them up from plastic bags at the entrance to the library. They would just like wait under your name and you'd come in and take a bag of books. But otherwise, I mean, now that the library is open, you can go in, go to the stacks. It's not that hard. Now, Hebrew specifically has a lot of digital access books. And I was actually kind of against digital access. I was always much more in favor of physical books. If I had a physical book and a digital book next to me, I would probably look at them both at the same time because they have different advantages. But for libraries, I would have preferred physical books. Maybe it's because I'm like old-fashioned or something. So what about you, Merle? How are you conducting your research?
So I've had a number of books now out for longer, both from actually the public library here in Annapolis and from the University of Maryland. So I've had books out from the public library for about 4 months now because I took them out about 2 weeks before lockdown began and it closed the public library. So I guess at some point I should return those. In terms of actual University of Maryland resources, I've used, as you'd have, a lot more e-library ones. HathiTrust was one way I got around this. They have made a lot of their library accessible. and I've used some interlibrary loan to get articles.
So did the UMD library operate the entire time? Did they do like Article Express or?
Yeah, so they've been sending articles from time to time that I've requested them. The real question, I think, is going to be a lot of these publishers made their journal articles and other resources available for free through, I think, the end of June, or in some cases, maybe a little bit later, maybe the end of the summer. And obviously, that's going to stop. I think they anticipated that they were going to give it for the rest of the academic year. But that's obviously not going to be the case indefinitely, in which case COVID-19, especially in the United States, looks like it's going to affect academic operations, certainly for at least the next year. So the question will be, everyone who was really excited to make their resources available for free for the last 3 or 4 months, what's going to happen now? Are they going to shut all that down?
Yeah, it's a good question. I know, for example, there's a research institute called Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., and they have periodically made some of the books they publish. So these would be primary sources, studies, reference works. So every once in a while, they make these accessible, so downloadable from their website. And I guess their model works, right? So these things might be free for a year or two, maybe even more, and then they'd be back in print and they would sell them. As a business model, it seems to work for them.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens moving forward.
Okay, so I guess we can conclude our episode on this note of research and future research.
Until next time, stay safe, stay socially distanced, and figure out when your library may open or may not.